And hello, Sun's House listeners. This is Andy Bomick, which means once again it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for over 3 months that I might possibly finish today, titled Angus, Thongs, and Full Frontal Snogging, Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled School of Fish. And then it's Ode to an Onion, A Walk in the Woods. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with The Big Leaf Leap. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today titled School of Fish. Shiny jelly-like balls float down, down, down. Emmy's eyes follow the blobs until they rest gently on the gravel at the bottom of the fish tank. These are eyed eggs, explains Miss Harris. See the black spots through the thin layer of the eggs? Those are eyes. We're going to hatch salmon to release into the wild. If you watch carefully the next few days, you might see movement inside the eggs, Miss Harris tells the class. Emmy winces. She's not sure she wants to see anything move, but she does watch and watches some more. She has never helped care for any kind of animal before. Miss Harris says salmon prefer very cold water. We need a volunteer to check the water temperature every morning. Emmy raises her hand, and Miss Harris shows her how to read the water temperature. Salmon prefer to live in water that's 55 to 64 degrees Fahrenheit. Each morning, Emmy gets to school 15 minutes early. She takes the water temperature and gazes at the eggs. 1 week passes, nothing yet. In science, the class learns about the six stages of a salmon's life: egg, alvin, fry, par, smolt, and adult. In art class, brushes splash watercolors onto fish cutouts. In gym, the class plays tag. Predators chase salmon. Only the fastest, smartest salmon survive. And then, one morning, when she is looking at the eggs, Emmy sees it. It's happening, she shouts. Desk empty as everyone angles for a good look. A few eggs wiggle, others jiggle. Bam! The first little head breaks through an orange egg membrane. Then another and another. What cute babies, says a boy. What cute Alvin, corrects Emmy. Each day, the students look into the tank. The Alvin have orange pouches called egg sacs attached to their bellies. The tiny fish get food from their sacs. As the Alvin gets bigger, the sacs get smaller. One morning, Emmy notices that the egg sacs have disappeared. It's Friday! It's Friday, she tells her classmates. No, it's Thursday, says her friend Evie. Emmy means our Alvin have become Fry, explains Miss Harris. Caring for Fry takes teamwork. Some students feed the growing fish. Others test the quality of the water, making sure the fish are getting the correct amount of food. In the writing nook, students make lists of words to describe the fry: twitchy, silvery, slippery, scaly. During library, they read books about the importance of salmon to indigenous people. Some of these tribes celebrate the salmon with artwork and ceremonies. During math, students figure out how far a salmon might swim during its lifetime. They learn salmon can swim up to 34 miles a day. Over the 2 to 7 years it lives, a salmon might travel 7,000 miles or more. Emmy gasps. She gets tired, paddling across the pool. Salmon release day nears. We'll load the fry into a cooler and take them to the stream, says Miss Harris. We'll look for the best release spot. She explains that boulders, logs, and shade help fry hide from predators such as birds and larger fish. Side channels in the stream and pools give the fry places to rest if water rush too quickly. Emmy is determined to help find the perfect spot for these tiny salmon. On release day, the class divides into groups. Parents and other teachers help each group. Some students stand in a field to practice casting fishing lines and reeling them back in. Some groups use magnifying glasses to examine water samples from the stream. They spy sand, feathery plants, and bugs with long legs. Still, others learn how non-native plants can harm wetlands. The fun has almost made Emmy forget about what she and her classmates came here to do. Almost. They gather at the stream where Miss Harris gives them all paper cups filled with water. One fry is swimming inside each cup. Name your fish, Miss Harris encourages them. There's a Jim, a Ralph, and a Scout. Some get silly names, Cheddar, Bubbles, Belly Button. Emmy names her fry Skipper. Wish your fry a safe trip, says Miss Harris. She stands by the water's edge. One by one, the students walk to the stream, kneel down, and gently tilt the cups, releasing their fry into the wild. Emmy whispers into her cup, I believe in you, Skipper. Emmy wonders how many of their fry will make it to adulthood. How many will survive the long trip from this small stream, all the way to the river and the ocean, then back to the stream to spawn? She worries about dangerous travel past dams and waterfalls. She knows many of the fish will be eaten by bears or eagles, even caught by people fishing along the way. Emmy is proud she is part of a school of students that raised a school of fish. Onion. Pablo was hard at work writing a long, sad poem. His pen whirled, the pages piled high. The clock struck 12. Pablo jumped. He was going to be late for lunch with his friend, Mathilde. He combed his hair and wished he didn't look so gloomy. Mathilde liked to laugh. She had a smile as wide as a guitar. Pablo tried to hide his glum expression behind a bouquet of poppies. No time for sadness, Mathilde said, as she filled a vase with water. Come, I need your help with lunch. Mathilde led Pablo to where fennel grew among tomato bushes. The air smelled like licorice and mud. These plants are always getting tangled up with each other, Mathilde said. She plucked a tomato. They must be fighting over who gets more sunshine, Pablo sighed. Oh no, Mathilde laughed. They're just doing a tango. Mathilde headed to where the air smelled tangy and sweet. My garlic has fallen in love with my roses, she said, harvesting a bulb. Pablo shook his head. How sad they have to separate. Oh, they'll meet again, Mathilde snipped a bud. Now for some onions. Mathilde strode to the peach tree. My onions grow here, she explained, because they want to protect the peaches. Their stalks do look like swords, Pablo said. He watched Mathilde pull a bulb from the dark earth. Thank you for taking care of the peaches, Mathilde whispered to the onion. Now I need you in my kitchen. Where it will only make you cry when you slice it up, Pablo shrugged. My dear poet, Matilda said, you are so glum today. All you see is sadness. Pablo said, my heart is heavy because I was writing a poem about poor miners who do very hard work. Matilda put her arm through Pablo's. Their work is for our salad. The onion's papery skin crinkled in Pablo's hand. As soon as he cut the onion, its earthy scent filled the air, making Pablo think of the garden, of the fennel struggling for sunlight, and the garlic longing for the roses. The scent burned Pablo's eyes. Tears streamed down his cheeks. At first, all he saw through his tears was a lovely vegetable. But then he noticed how the sunlight shone through the onion's layers. This onion came out of the dark earth, Pablo said, to shine like a bright moon. Aren't onions beautiful? Matilda smiled. Wait till you taste it. Pablo bit into a slice. First came sharpness, then came sweetness. He offered Matilda a piece. Thank you, he said, wiping away tears, for reminding me that even though there is sadness in the world, there is so much happiness. Even in the simplest things, Matilda said, wiping away her own tears. Like onions, Pablo said. You should write about that, Matilda laughed. Lumorous onion, Pablo proclaimed, lifting the onion up high. Sad things have always made me cry, but you have made me cry tears of joy. For that, I will celebrate you as only a poet can, with an ode. But first, Matilda said, let's eat. And here's the story about Pablo and Matilda. Pablo Neruda was born in Chile in 1904. He began writing poetry when he was a young boy. And at the age of 19, he became famous for a book of love poems. Because Pablo was a sensitive person who noticed injustices everywhere, he used the power of his poems to describe what he saw, hoping his readers would be touched and want to make the world a better place. After publishing many books of elevated poems, Pablo began writing simple odes because he wanted to write about common, everyday, and happy things, like socks and soup. Around this time, he met Matilda Yaruta at a concert in a park in Santiago, Chile. Matilda was a folk singer who laughed easily and often. Pablo revealed in her light-hearted spirit, and they fell in love. They built a home together where Matilda kept an abundant garden, and Pablo worked at a driftwood table, writing odes about everything from corn to artichokes and, yes, even onions. Among Pablo's most celebrated works are Selected Odes, Canto General, and 20 Love Poems, and A Song of Despair. He also wrote a memoir called I Confess I Have Lived. This story, Ode to an Onion, was inspired by Pablo's poem, Oda a la Cibola, and Matilda's memoirs, My Life with Pablo Neruda. And here is the actual Ode to the Onion by Pablo Neruda. Onion, luminous vessel, petal by petal, your beauty formed. Scales of glass made you swell. And in the secrecy of the dark earth, your womb grew round with dew. Beneath the earth, the miracle happened. And when your clumsy green sprout appeared, and your blades, like swords, were born in the garden, the earth amassed her power, bringing forth your naked transparency. And as in Aphrodite's birth, the remote sea reproduced the magnolia, raising up its bosom. Like that the earth made you, onion, bright as a planet, and destined to shine. Constant constellation, round rows of water upon the dining table of the poor. Generous you undo your globe of freshness in the fervent consumption of the pot, and in the fiery heat of the oil, a sliver of glass becomes a curled feather of gold. I shall also recall how fertile your influence was on the salad's love, and the heavens seemed to conspire, giving you the fine shape of hail to celebrate your sharp sting upon the hemispheres of a tomato, but within the reach of the people's hands, showered with oil, sprinkled with a little salt, you vanquish the hunger of the laborer along the hard road. Poor people's star, fairy godmother, wrapped in delicate paper, you arise from soil, eternal, intact, pure, like the seed of a star, and upon cutting you, the kitchen knife draws forth the only sorrowless tear. You made us cry without hurting us. I have sung the praises of everything, onion, but to me you are most beautiful than a bird of dazzling feathers. In my eyes you are heavenly globe, platinum goblet, motionless dance of the snowy sea anemone, and the scent of the earth lives in your translucent nature. A Walk in the Woods. A week after the funeral, I stare in the morning mirror, angry that my father's eyes stare back at me. Why, Dad? Why did you have to leave? After breakfast, I open the envelope Dad left behind. Breathe, I tell myself. I reach inside and find a map of the woods beyond our house, with a marked spot, shouting in bright red, treasure. What is this? I was hoping for a letter, some special advice, a secret even, not some stupid map. Besides, the woods were our place. Why would Dad ask me to go back without him? I fling the letter across the room, see it sail into my closet, land behind my hiking boots. Wait, is this a sign? I lace up and head into the woods. I stomp past the split rock that sits at the trailhead and nearly crush Sal, the garter snake. Sorry, I usually notice Sal coiled near the entrance. Slow down. Pay attention, I tell myself. Sal slithers behind a rock, like I sometimes wish I could. The soft song of a Carolina wren settles me as I sidestep fallen limbs, keep an eye peeled for rabbits, and survey the stairway of mushrooms sprouting from the trunk of a tree. And with each step, the hurt inside my heart pounds less and less. I take a deep breath, then drink in the quiet until there's movement in the bushes. What's that? I ask. An eagle answers with an explosion of flight, rocketing its great normal body far above the white pines that skim the sky. Whoa! Did you see that, Dad? The last time we were here, I shake my head and let the memory drift away. Just find the treasure, I tell myself. I hike up one hill, down the next, loop close enough to the Hudson to catch a glint of water peeking through hickory, beech, and black oak that go on forever. A few low branches reach out as greedy for touch as me. Beep, 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 an anxious brood of grouse makes sounds almost like weeping. It takes me a minute to find the half-hidden nest. Where's your mama? I ask. I'm tempted to pick them up, but I know it's best to leave them be. I hope their mother returns. Not every parent does, or can. My stomach growls. I take a swig of water, gobble a handful of nuts, and pull out Dad's map. The treasure should be up ahead, just past the ancient stone water storage house, left centuries ago by a tribe of the Mohican Nation. What was it Dad used to say? There's always something that remains. There, a lonely brick fireplace stands, the house it belonged to long gone. I've been here before, but it's different now. There's something new in the fireplace, masked by a messy blanket of twigs and long grasses. I reach behind and wait. I feel something cold. Take a quick look around to make sure no one's watching, then slowly pull out a rusted metal box. That's locked. Great, I mutter. Now what, Dad? Your pocket, he whispers. There, in the envelope, along with the map, is a key. I swear it wasn't there before. Afraid to breathe, I slip the key in the lock and turn. Inside sits a shelf of papers, wrapped in plastic. Protection from the rain? Drawings? Portraits of wildlife in the woods? I spread the yellowed pages out on a nearby picnic table and read the unfinished story scrawled beneath each sketch. Garter snake. Quick, someone's coming to gather the sun-beaten diamonds along your coiled, cold-blooded body. I wonder how much those diamonds are worth. Hurry, slither behind those rocks leading into the woods. I'll see you again tomorrow. White-tailed deer. No knock on the front door. Just some creature tiptoeing in at breakfast. She looks up, paws the grass, slippery with dew, staring down. What? Who? Suddenly, she leaps. Tail in the air, a white flag waving goodbye. But why? Northeast red fox. An earth of foxes is given chase. Young red fox races the wind. His cousins fall far behind. What becomes of them? One safe, he pauses and dares look back. Too late. Great horned owl. Ghost-like, she appears in the night. A hoot, a flutter of majestic wings. She glides to a branch of the nearest sugar maple. Her gold-flecked eyes bore into me, thinking, what? No time for answers. Her mate awaits. One hoot, and she's gone. Where? There's more sketches of life on and above the forest floor. Mallard, marmot, tree frog, turkey vulture, bracket fungus, black mushrooms, orchids. Jack in the pulpit blooms, each beautifully odd or oddly beautiful. Who drew these? I flip through the drawings, desperate for clues. Squinting at the bottom of one page, I notice tiny initials. Dad's. No way. There's a date, too. Multiplying the mystery. He was my age when he drew these. I close my eyes and feel Dad next to me, his hand on my shoulder, light as leaves. My heart feels lighter, too. I open my eyes, turn to the last page, and find it blank, except for a note. I leave you these drawings, these scribbles, and mostly this forest. The true treasure, finish my stories or not. But this last page is for you, son. Draw and write your own story. I'll always be watching. I gently place the drawings back inside the box, tuck it under one arm, and wipe my eyes. Can you smile and cry at the same time? It doesn't matter. I breathe in the river-scented air, sigh, and head back to the house. But in no particular hurry, Dad knew I needed this walk in the woods. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled The Big Leaf Leap. The girl wanted a big leaf pile to leap in, a huge leaf pile, an enormously enormous leaf pile. She wanted it deep and soft and crunchy and springy. She wanted it tall enough and wide enough to leap into all afternoon. So she raked and raked and raked, with the warm sun on her back and the cool breeze in her hair, until every red star maple leaf in her entire yard was mounded up in one pile. But the pile wasn't big enough for the girl. It was not huge enough. It was not nearly enormous enough. She frowned. Then she heard laughing from next door. She peered over the fence and said, "Hey!" The laughing stopped, and negotiations started. Soon, the two small leaf piles became one bigger leaf pile, with red star maple leaves and brown lobed oak leaves, but the pile wasn't big enough for the girl and the boy next door. It was not huge enough. It was not nearly enormous enough. They frowned. Then they heard shrieking from across the street. They looked both ways and ran over. "Hey," they said. The shrieking stopped, and negotiations started. Soon, the three small leaf piles became one even bigger leaf pile, with red star maple leaves and brown-lobed oak leaves and yellow fan ginkgo leaves. But the pile wasn't quite big enough for the girl and the boy next door and the kids across the street. It was not quite huge enough. It was almost enormous enough, but not quite. They frowned. Then they heard shouting from down the block. Angry shouting. They raised their eyebrows and shrugged their shoulders and hustled down there to check it out. The twins down the block were fighting because their leaf pile wasn't big enough for two kids to jump in at the same time. And what do you know? The girl and the boy next door and the kids across the street knew just what to do about that. So the fighting stopped and negotiations started. Soon, the twins helped haul their leaf pile up the block to the vacant lot. The others brought their pile too, till the red star maple leaves and the brown-lobed oak leaves and the yellow fan ginkgo leaves and the gold heart aspen leaves made a small mountain together. But the kids looked at each other and shook their heads and scrunched up their noses. They added every leaf they could find from the whole street, sawtoothed birch leaves and bright-fringed honey locust leaves and fiery red sumac leaves and big-as-your-head catapalla leaves, until before them towered the biggest leaf pile, the hugest leaf pile, the most enormously enormous leaf pile ever. It was deep and soft and crunchy and springy. It was tall enough and wide enough to leap into all afternoon. And all the kids from the whole neighborhood circled around it, with the warm sun on their backs and the cool breeze in their hair. They looked at that leaf mountain, these kids, all tired and dirty and sweaty and happy and ready to play. "One," the girl said. "Two, three, leap." And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bomick, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for about, little over 3 months. And that I might possibly finish today, titled Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging, Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. I am a facsimile of a sham of a fax of a person. Georgia Nicholson's life is far from simple. Her cat, Angus, is the size of a small Labrador. Her three-year-old sister may have peed somewhere in her room, and her best friend, Jazz, thinks she looks like an alien just because she accidentally shaved off her eyebrows. Enter the sex god. This just might turn out to be the most fabbity fab year ever. Okay, last week, Robbie the sex god kissed Elizabeth at the Stiff Dylan's concert. Robbie said he's wanted to do that for a long time, but he felt that that was wrong. He then said, see you later, and said he'd call her. Then Robbie left with Lindsay. Lindsay told Elizabeth that Robbie is her boyfriend and to stay away from him. Elizabeth is very frustrated about Robbie. And that's where I left off last week. 9 p.m. The phone rang for me. I said to Mom, who is it? And she said, I don't know. It's a boy. 9:30 p.m. Robbie is going to meet me tomorrow after school at my house. He was in a phone box and said that he couldn't really explain. He'd talk tomorrow. If he thinks he can explain this away, he's very much mistaken. I have got some pride. I've got a lot to say to him about his explanation. 9:45 p.m. What shall I wear? Maybe I won't go to school tomorrow to give myself time to get made up in a natural way. Friday, July 2nd, 8:05 a.m. Said goodbye to Mom and Libs and went as normal to Jazz's. She was waiting for me on the corner. I said, I'm not coming to school today. I'm meeting Robbie. Will you say that I have got the painters in very badly? Thanks. Then I went back home. I waited until Mom and Libs left, and then I slipped back into the house. Day plan. 1. Steam face. 2. Apply face mask. 3. Sort out clothes to wear. 4. Tidy bedroom. Well, put everything on the floor and push under the bed. 5. Put some interesting books near my bed. Hide comics and boy mags. 6. Remove nutty pants. Poster of Reeves and Mortimer. 7. Make sure Libby has not peed or pooped in any secret corner. 11 a.m. In my room tidying when I heard the front door open. If it was a burglar, I only had Mum's tweezers to defend myself with. Where was Angus when you needed him? I hadn't seen the mad furry thing for hours. 11:02 a.m. Not burglars. It's something much worse. It's Mum. And she's not alone. She has Jim, the decorator, with her. Oh, fabulous. My mom is having an affair with a builder. Also, she is older than him. Also, I already have a dad who is bad enough, but better the dad you know than the builder you don't. They went into the living room, so I crept downstairs to see if I could hear what was going on. I put my ear against the door, but I couldn't quite hear. I pressed my ear quite hard up against the keyhole. I heard Jim say, "This is the door that sticks. I'm going to..." And that's when he opened the door, and I crashed into the room. Noon. In bed, I had to pretend that I had fainted. I lay still on the floor until Mom put something disgusting, smelling salts, under my nose. I thought my head was going to come off. I sort of pretended that I was all confused and that I had felt ill on the way to school. Mom made me come to bed with an aspirin. Soon after, I heard the door slam. Mom came up. I just took an hour off to discuss the final details about the living room with Jim. I said, he's taken about 100 years to decorate one room. Libby thinks he is our new dad. Mom laughed. Don't be so silly. Why would you think she thought that? I said, because she calls him my new dad. Mom ignored that and went on, well, I must get back to work. Are you sure you will be all right? I said, oh, yes, I'll be all right. Will you be all right? I said it really meaningfully, but she didn't know what I meant. Minutes later, she came back in the room and said, Georgia, I know that you like a bit of drama, but I'm afraid that Jim and I are not having a passionate affair. I said, oh, what is it then? A really lukewarm affair? She sat down on my bed. It's not any kind of affair. Look, love, I really, really miss your dad. And it was horrible because her eyes were all leaky. I said, you can't miss his mustache. She said, no, I don't miss that, but I love him. Don't you? I said, yeah, he's all right. She kissed me. I know you do love him. You're just moody, and someone has to suffer. But never mind, we'll be seeing him soon. Then she left. God, I can't stand this, having to talk about grown-ups all the time. I do wish my dad was here, then I could forget all about him. 4 p.m. Robbie will be here in a half an hour. I'd better just go to the loo again. I've only been 10 times in the last 10 minutes. I hope I'm not incontinent. I'll have to wear big nappies. Robbie will never stand for that. If he gets famous, he won't want a girlfriend who wears nappies. 6:30 p.m. Robbie has just gone. I feel all hollow inside, like a hollowed-out coconut. He looks so gorgeous, all in black, and sort of sad. He gave me a brilliant smile when he saw me, and then he just pulled me toward him. Quite roughly, actually. I remembered how cross I was, though, so I only snogged him for half an hour before I said, "How could you tell Lindsay that I was sad and that I followed you outside and flung myself on you?" He looked puzzled. "I didn't say that." "Didn't you?" "No, I didn't. I haven't said anything to anyone." "Well, that's what Lindsay said to me." He looked uncomfortable. I went on. "And are you engaged to her or not?" He looked really puzzled then. "Engaged to her? Why should you think that?" "Well, because she wears an engagement ring at school that she tells people you gave her." He sat down. Oh, this is bad. I tried to go on being cross, but he looked so porgy, that I couldn't keep it up. Then he looked right into my eyes. I tried not to blink because not blinking is supposed to be attractive. He said, "Look, Georgie, I'm having real trouble with this. The truth is, I've been trying to find a way to end it with Lindsay, but I don't want to hurt her feelings." I said, "Yes, it's tricky, isn't it? Because she obviously likes you a lot. Still, I've got an idea." He looked hopeful. "What is it?" "Well, I'll tell her, in a nice way, of course, that she's a wet weed and that she's being dumped. That should do it." He did actually laugh. He said, "You're mad. Anyway, it's my problem, and I'll sort it out. But there is something else I have to tell you." "Here it comes," I was thinking, but not blinking. "He's going to say, 'You're the girl of my dreams. Will you be my girlfriend? You're the most gorgeous girl I have ever—'" I just got to that bit in my head when he interrupted me. "I have to tell you, it wouldn't be fair to you not to. But, well, I'm attracted to you." I tried not to smirk or smile too much in case he had second thoughts when he saw my nose spreading all over my face. "But I can't go out with you." I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because you're too young. I'm nearly 18. It wouldn't be right. It would be like cradle snatching." I argued with him. I even said, I'm not really 14. I'm actually 15 and a half. It's just that I'm not very bright, and they've kept me back a year. He laughed, but in a sad way. Then he gave me a last kiss sort of thing and went. Midnight. Too young for him. Oh, Murdy, 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 double Murdy. I wonder where Angus is. I could do with something to cuddle, even if I did get a savage biting. Monday, July 5th, 11:30 a.m. Mucho excitamundo. Robbie has dumped Lindsay. Hurrah! She came to school with her eyes all swollen up like little boiled sweets. I passed her in the corridor, and she said, I hope you're satisfied now, you horrid little girl. Horrid little girl, that's nice. I could have said, at least I don't wear bits of rubber down my bra and a piece of string up my bottom. But unfortunately, I began to feel a bit sorry for her. After all, she would never get another boyfriend, whereas even if I had to wait a whole year, I would one day be older, and then I could get Robbie. 5:30 p.m. I'm glum, though. A year seems a long, long time. And what if he finds someone else before I get old enough? 6:30 p.m. Still no sign of Angus. This is a bit unusual. He always comes back for his din-dins. 7 p.m. Looking around the street for Angus. I had a dead mouse and a chop to entice him. 7:15 p.m. Just stumbled into Mark, snogging in his driveway with some girl. He's always at it. If it's true that stimulation makes things bigger, breast, etc., perhaps he had very tiny lips when he was born, and he has just overstimulated them by snogging all the time. 9:30 p.m. No Angus. I hoped he might be at home, lurking behind the curtain, ready to attack my legs. But he's not. 11 p.m. No phone calls, no Angus. Libby came into bed with me. Where's Big Pussy Tosser? She asked me. I almost cried. I really cuddled her, but it made her too cross, and she bit me on the chin. Had a dream about Robbie. I had blonde hair in the dream. Tuesday, July the 6th, 7:30 p.m. Eureka! I've got it. I know what my dream was trying to tell me. There is a way I can convince Robbie that I am more mature than my 14 years. I have to dye a blonde streak in my hair. A blonde streak will add years to my appearance. Still no sign of Angus. Mom said, I don't want to upset you, but you know that he stalks cars and attacks them. It may be that this time he's had a bit of an accident. I can't bear to think of this. Midnight. I think of all the animals in the world and all the sad things that happen to them. Little chickens whose parents go for a day's outing on the farmyard truck and never come back because they have gone to be on somebody's table. And all the little sheep who see their mummies and daddies loaded into vans. Oh, I cannot stand this. I'm never going to eat meat again. 1 a.m. They say vegetables feel pain. What about the little baby potatoes, all snug underground, with their brothers and sister potatoes, and then a big hand comes and uproots them and slices them up? Oh, God, now I can never eat chips again. 2:30 a.m. What can I eat then? Wednesday, July the 7th, 8 a.m. I'm shattered this morning and upset. I miss Angus. Even Mom does. Mrs. Next Door doesn't, though. When I ask her if she had seen him, she said, no, I haven't. And I know she hasn't been in my yard because nothing is dead or dug up, and my dog is not a nervous wreck. I hate her. I hope her husband gets stuck in his greenhouse, and then she will know what I feel like. She will know what true pain is. and suffering. 2:30 p.m. Ink flight in RE, which generally cheers me up, but I couldn't even flick properly. I was so upset. The gossip at school is that Lindsay is not eating and has got, what's it, anorexia. I don't know how you would know. She's so skinny anyway. Nearly the summer holds, so it will be the last I see of this hellhole for a bit. Friday, July the 9th, 8:50 p.m. I really think Angus must have been run over or something. I miss him. We've been through a lot of stuff, me and him, stupid furry freak. But I love him. It seems I am destined to lose everything I love. Sunday, July the 11th, 2 o'clock p.m. Jazz and I looked in all the streets around our house, just in case Angus had followed me one day and then lost his way. We were just by her place when Robbie pulled up in his Mini. He looked a bit ruffled, but I was too down in the dumps to think about it much. He said, "Have you found Angus?" I said, "No, we've looked everywhere." Wednesday, July the 4th, 3:30 p.m. Every cloud has a bit of a silver lining. I was sitting against the school wall in the shade, just thinking. The others were all sprawled out, sunbathing by the tennis courts. The bit of wall I was leaning against was just near Elvis's hut. I saw him put on his coat and get his shopping bag. What a Wally he looked. He closed the hut door, but he didn't lock it, and then he went off. I'd nothing else to do, so I thought I'd go and sit in his hut for a while, see what it would be like to be a school caretaker. There was nothing much in the hut, a chair and a table and a little fridge and some magazines he'd been reading. I sat down and flicked through them, and my jaw nearly dropped off because they were naughty magazines, if you know what I mean, called Fiesta and Big Girls. One of them was called Down Your Way and was all full of candid photos of readers and their wives in the privacy of their own bedrooms. Some of them were so fat. I flicked through the pages to the centerfold, and the centerfold was Elvis and Mrs. Elvis in Nutty Pants. I couldn't believe it. Elvis in the Nutty Pants? Elvis was standing by the kettle in his Nutty Pants, pretending to make a cup of tea. And Mrs. Elvis was doing the washing up in the Nutty Pants. I took the mag with me and passed it around the whole class. We were laughing for the whole afternoon. Someone only had to say, "Fancy a cup of tea, my dear?" And we'd be off again. Oh, it made my stomach really hurt with laughing. Elvis knows someone has got his mag, but he can't say anything. If I see him, I'll just let my eyes drift down to his trousers. Saturday, July 17th, 12 p.m. Joy, joy, double, double joy. Hattie, ha, ha, ha. Robbie has just phoned me. He has found Angus. Robbie had been out searching for him, and he heard all these dogs barking, so he went to see what they were barking at. And it was Angus, tied up. Some people had found him. He had a bad paw, so they had bandaged it up and tied him up until they found his owners. They had put up notices, but I hadn't seen them. Robbie said the people were bloody glad to get rid of him, as he had already eaten two doormats and a clothesline. They were lucky they got off so lightly. Anyway, Robbie is going to bring him around to me at 5 o'clock. 1 p.m. Mom's out, and I'm determined to make Robbie realize that I'm a great deal older than I was 15 days ago. I haven't any money, and Mom has selfishly taken her purse with her, but I have a plan. 2 p.m. There is some peroxide that Gran uses to clean her dentures when she comes to stay. It's kept in the bathroom cupboard, and I'm going to use it to bleach a really sophisticated streak of blonde in my hair at the front. 2:30 p.m. I put it on. I wonder how long you have to leave it. It's stinging my scalp, so that must be a good sign. 3:30 p.m. It's gone a sort of orange color. Aw, bloody hell. I'll have to put some more on. 4:15 p.m. Now it's gone sort of bright yellow. I look like a canary. 5 p.m. Thank goodness it's gone white. I think it looks quite good. It feels a bit stiff, though. Oh, well, it'll soften up in time. I think it makes me look at least 4 years older. 5:30 p.m. Robbie here with Angus. I was so pleased to see him. I tried to give him a cuddle, but he lashed out at me and was hissing until I gave him a rabbit leg. Then he started purring. Angus, not Robbie. Robbie noticed my hair when I stood up. He was obviously impressed because he said, wow, you've got a white streak in your hair. I said, oh yes, do you like it? There was a bit of silence between us. I was thinking, go on, kiss me. But he said, look, this isn't easy for me. I think I should go now. I said, thank you for Angus. He said, oh, that's okay. I knew you liked him. The scratches will heal in time, and I should be able to replace the trousers. As he was leaving, I had one final go to make him see that I was mature and sophisticated beyond my years. I flicked my hair back like they do in the movies, and then I made the mistake of running my fingers through my hair. The white streak snapped off in my hand. I was just left holding it there in my hand. Robbie looked amazed. He looked at the hunk of hair in my hand, and then he looked at me, and then he started laughing. He said, God, you're weird, and then he kissed me. I shoved the hunk of hair on the sofa, and Angus pounced on it. He must have thought it was a hamster or something. After a bit of number six kissing, Robbie said, well, look, let's take it easy and start seeing each other, shall we? See how it goes. Maybe keep it a bit quiet from people at first. So all is well that ends well. I am now nearly Robbie's girlfriend. Ha, 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 ha. Summer love, summer love. The end. 9 p.m. Mom came in. Right. We're all set. I've got them, I said in a sort of romantic daze. What have you got, Muddy? I've got the tickets for us. Tickets for what? Tickets for New Zealand. When you said you wanted to go, I went and booked them. Dad paid for them, and we're off to Wangamatata next week. Sacre bleu and merde. And that completes the book, Angus, Thongs, and Full Frontal Snogging, Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. Okay, as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, we might have enough time to begin a brand new book, and that's what I'm going to do right now. And the name of the book is titled The 57 Bus, the true story of two teenagers and the crime that changed their lives. One teenager in a skirt, one teenager with a lighter, one moment that changes both of their lives forever. If it weren't for the 57 bus, Sasha and Richard never would have met. Both were high school students in Oakland, California, one of the most diverse cities in the country. But they inhabited different worlds. Sasha lived in the middle-class foothills and attended a small private school. Richard lived in the economically challenged flatlands and attended a large public one. After school each day, their paths overlapped on the bus for a mere 8 minutes. But one afternoon, a single reckless act left Sasha severely burned and Richard charged with two hate crimes and facing life imprisonment. The case garnered international attention, thrusting both teenagers into the spotlight. But in The 57 Bus, author Dashika Slater shows that what might at first seem like a simple matter of right and wrong, justice and injustice, victim and criminal, is something more complicated and far more heartbreaking. This true story, first chronicled in the New York Times Magazine by Slater and artfully, compassionately, and expertly expanded upon here, is a riveting exploration of race, class, gender, identity, mortality, and forgiveness, told with honesty and insight gleaned from both teens' lives. The 57 Bus will inspire you to rethink all you know about crime, punishment, and empathy. Author's note: this is a true story. All the people in this book are real, although in some cases, pseudonyms or initials were used. Young people are identified by first name only. The details of this story were pieced together from a variety of sources, including interviews, documents, letters, videos, diaries, social media posts, and public records. Quotes from these sources are verbatim, except in a few cases where I removed last names, replacing them with long dashes. Information from first-hand accounts was corroborated with official records whenever possible, unless those records were sealed and are not available to the public. In those cases, I relied on the memory of witnesses and participants. The pronouns and names used for gender nonconforming people were approved by the people in question. Monday, November 4th, 2013. By 4:30 in the afternoon, the first mad rush of after-school passengers has come and gone. What's left are stragglers and stay-laters, swiping their bus passes as they climb onto the 57 bus and take seats among the coming-home workers, the shoppers, and errand-doers. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, The 57 Bus. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.